Welcome to Pick Me Up, I'm Scared, the podcast.
I'm your host, Madeline.
And I'm your co-host, Kenna.
Okay, Kenna, today I wanted to ask, if you were to think of, like, the traditional American dream, what would that look like to you?
Oh, gosh, I think about the house with the yard, the white picket fence, what is it, 2.5 children, like some sort of like pet, like a dog and a cat.
A golden retriever.
Yeah, I had one as a kid.
Oh, that's cute.
Yeah, Ginger.
Oh,
miss her. But so yeah, and I think about like, this is fucked up because I know we talked about lawns, but I think about like the lawn. And you do a lawnmower, and you have a car.
Maybe like a minivan.
You have like a minivan to haul around the children, and then you have like another car, like a nicer car for going to work.
Like a sedan.
Like a sedan. You got a sedan and a minivan, and like a garage that's like filled with junk and tools, and that you kind of used for house repairs and stuff.
I think that's pretty good, honestly. That's what I think of.
Yeah, I mean, like, I guess it's, like, like what we would consider, like, regular middle-class life. And, like, you go on vacation once a year.
Right, it's, like, middle-class suburban life. But I feel like it's definitely hinged around the house thing.
Yes.
And I do know we talked about the front yard with the white picket fence and how evil that is, like, on our very, very first episode.
Yes, yes.
Right, and it's probably killing the planet. But, yeah, it was always, like, a single-family house, like a one-story, two-story house in the suburbs with a big yard. And I think that's interesting because, like, my original dream for my life was just to live in, like, an apartment. Like, I don't know, I feel like I feel safer higher up, no flooding, you know, you're a relatively safe place. And also, I didn't want to have to deal with, like, outdoor space, you know, like, that looks stressful. But then I ended up buying my little house because the down payment was cheaper for this than for an apartment, which is annoying and weird. But yeah, so did you have that same, what was your version of the American dream?
Oh, like, well, when I was a kid, what I wanted to do, I wanted to be an architect. And I wanted to, this is sounds so silly. Well, like as a kid where it's like, I would build my own huge house and me and all my friends would live in the huge house. And we'd all have our own cool rooms where we would, that we would decorate exactly how we wanted.
I love that. That's like communal living was basically your goal.
It basically was where I was just like, and we're going to have like a huge yard where we like party and like barbecue and like do like art stuff.
That sounds really fun. I like that. Yeah, mine was definitely like the apartment and then I like make clothes for a living and I always thought I would live in my apartment in New York and make clothes for a living and I would have two boyfriends that lived with me.
Cool.
That was like always my thing.
I don't know. I think I wanted to go to some fancy college for a long time I wanted to be like an architect and like make my own house to live in and make like other cool like houses and stuff. I did like drafting and stuff, but
I think that's fun.
I thought I was gonna be an engineer for a while, but I cannot do math. It's fine.
Well, I think like the interesting thing about this, like the idea of the American dream, is that even, like, me, for what I wanted, like, I couldn't even buy an apartment if I wanted to. Even though the price of the apartment was cheaper, I wouldn't qualify to buy an apartment because the down payments have to be higher.
So weird.
Yeah, it's like, because here in the U.S., you can get this thing called an FHA loan to buy your first house, and some, like, condos are eligible for them. But in L.A., it's, like, just a really small handful, and they're never on the market. So if you want to buy a house in Los Angeles or, like, a home, it's easier to buy a house than it is a condo here, which is wild. So that's why I ended up buying my weird little house instead of the condo. And of course, obviously I did it in a weird way because I couldn't afford a full house. Like I didn't have enough of a down payment for the apartment condo thing, but I didn't have enough of a budget for a whole ass house because houses are so much more expensive. So I went in with my best friend and we bought a duplex so we could each have our own little place, right? Obviously. And I feel like now that I'm thinking about it, a lot of that problem could be solved if FHA loans, where you could buy a place, your first place with 3.5% as a down payment, if that just, like, applied to apartments.
Yeah.
Like, condos, how much of, like, our housing issues would be solved?
Yeah, because, like, when you live in an apartment, like, most, like, I, even though, like, I have rent control, like, before that, like, I always lived in fear of, like, having to move. Like, right. It's not, like, permanent, where it's, like, when you know that you have, like, a permanent space, even if it's not your dream space, it just takes off so much stress because you never have to worry about, like, finding another place.
Right.
You know, when, especially, like, you know, if I had to find another place when, like, times were really lean for me, like, that would have been so rough.
Yeah, I mean, even, like, well, in LA, one of the things I do, which I definitely don't actually do if you're law enforcement listening to this at all, is I make fake pay stubs and confirm fake employment for, like, everybody in the city. Like, I have done this for so many people. I, like, make them pay stubs. I'm like, yeah, you work for me. That's right. Look, here you are. And write letters, you know. Because it's even hard to, like, qualify to rent an apartment. Because you have to usually show that you make, like, 3 times the rent.
And that's, like, almost impossible. Like,
yeah.
Like, if you work a regular job in any city where it's, like, not maybe not minimum wage, but not, like, good, like, most places you cannot pay 4 times the rent. You're paying half to 60% of your income on rent.
Yeah.
Like, I, for most of my life, have paid, like, half my income to rent.
Yeah, if half of the income, I would be like, that's good. I'm doing great. You know? Like, it's only half of my income. But anyway, so, okay, I was thinking about all this, and what it led me to, this weird, like, housing thing, and American dream thing, and thinking back to, like, our first episode about the front yards, what it led me to is the single family home.
Hmm.
Yeah. So, okay, Kenna, how would you define a single family home?
Gosh, I think about, like, all the TV shows I watched growing up where it would be, like, you know, two parents, a couple of kids in one house that is on one lot with a front and backyard. And neighbors that are close, but not right up next to you.
Yeah, I feel like that's it, right? It's like one building, and usually it's freestanding, but maybe if you live in a city with, like, urban density, maybe, like, your side walls touch the neighbors.
Yeah, like if you lived in, like, the Bay Area. Like, right. When I was a kid, I loved Full House. And
yes.
That's what I thought of as, like, kind of a single family home.
Right, but for the most part, you know, you got one lot and it's just one house on it. It's like one building on that lot, and that building has just one unit in it, and everybody's living in it. You live in the whole house, and the building is just your house, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and this would be different than living in, like, an apartment or a condo or a townhouse, where maybe your home is just one part of a bigger building filled with lots of other homes in it. Or, like, a duplex, which is a house divided into two separate units. Or, like, what I live in, which is a detached duplex, which is one plot of land, but instead of having just one house with a huge backyard, it has two totally separate houses, plopped one in front of the other with a little space in between. So that would be, like, yeah, the detached duplex, what I live in. And, of course, my best friend and I, you know, went in on it together because it was cheaper. It was half the price of just buying a single-family home mm-hmm. on a plot of land. But yeah, so Kenna, you're also looking to buy a home here in LA right now.
Yes.
Yes. And what have you noticed in the process, like, when searching for houses? What is, like, some trends in housing you've seen?
I mean, they're fucking expensive in LA.
Yeah.
I don't know what the trends are. Sometimes when I'm like, oh, this is a great deal, it's cash only.
Yeah, that's true.
Like,
because they're not in, like, inhabitable conditions, so they won't pass for
a loan. To me, they're inhabitable conditions, because I've lived in some shitholes. I'm like, if it has a place you can put a toilet, it is good to go.
That's actually really funny, because, yeah, our friend Camilla just bought a house, and it's, like, not in great shape, right? And some people who saw it have been like, why did you buy this? Like, this is in terrible condition. And she's like, I've literally rented places in worse condition than this. Like, she lived in one place in Atwater Village where the roof had a giant hole in it and would just leak down on her bed all the time.
Oh, yeah. My apartment is very, very lopsided. So, like, things roll because it's very uneven. My shower is not a real shower. It's built with drywall.
Oh, what?
I don't know how to describe it, but, so it is, like, There are so many things wrong with my apartment. Like, so many things.
Yeah, that's what's interesting. It's like there are higher requirements, again, to get a mortgage on a house, because technically the bank owns it till you pay off your loan, right? They just let you live in it while you're paying it off. And they are like, well, I'm not buying some shithole, you know? But then when we rent, it's like there's hardly any regulations. You could just rent the most absolutely horrifying place. What's
wild to me is in California, you don't have to, like, in, okay, because I moved here from Oregon. In Oregon, if you rent a place, it legally has to have a fridge and a stove.
Oh, no, we don't have to have that.
Yeah, so it blew my mind when people would be like, oh, yeah, I'm taking my fridge and my stove with me. And I'm like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, yeah. Here, like, it's very common to have to get your own fridge to move into an apartment.
I had a friend who didn't have a fridge. She just couldn't afford one, so she just didn't buy perishable food.
Yeah, that's pretty wild. Well, one of the things that, like, I think about is here in LA, we have a lot of single-family homes compared to, like, other major metropolitan cities. So almost half of Los Angeles is just single family housing rather than like apartment buildings, which we see being common in other major cities. So in New York, for example, just 16% of the city is single family dwellings. But again, in the city of LA, it's like 49% or something like that.
Wow, that's a lot for a big city. I guess like LA County like is huge.
Right, and LA County's massive.
And it's very spread out. But even, like, the city of LA, I thought, would have denser housing.
Well, the thing that's interesting is that in terms of, like, the land, like, if you just looked at the land, I think it's actually 75% of the land is single family only. But because of, like, the density of the plots of land where they do build apartments.
Like downtown or something?
Yeah, exactly. It's 49% of the homes are single family.
That kind of makes sense.
Right. Yeah, yeah. So, but all of this means that here in LA, housing is super competitive because we have this finite amount of land to work with, right? And rather than building tall buildings up high in the sky where we can fit multiple units, we just got all these single-story houses with huge back and front yards in a city. And it's a really inefficient use of space, and it means that we don't have enough housing for people here, basically. And the housing we do have is just much more expensive than it otherwise might be because of supply and demand issues, and the demand is just way higher than the supply. And this is something that happens across the United States, but also uniquely happens more in California, especially compared to other cities like worldwide. Mm-hmm. And in the United States on the whole, especially compared to like Europe or something like that. But all of it started actually in Berkeley.
Interesting.
Right? Yeah. So in 1916, Berkeley, which is of course a town in like the Bay Area just east of San Francisco, they passed this newfangled thing, 1916, like that's 16, not 60. So they passed this zoning rule in this neighborhood called Elmwood that made it illegal to build anything other than one home on one lot in the entire neighborhood. And Kenna, can you guess what maybe the driving force of this decision was?
Oh gosh, is it like just every episode where it's like racism?
Yeah, it's racism. God. Yeah.
I'm not surprised. I just, you know, sometimes you want a good reason why things happen. Like, you know, sometimes you want to give people the benefit of the doubt. Be like, well, you know, they tried, but it just had bad consequences. No.
We just tried to do racism. That's all we did. Whole country for many years, still today, we just were trying to find new and creative ways to do racism. So basically, this guy, Duncan McDuffie, which is just really the douchiest name I've ever heard.
It sounds like an 80s movie villain.
Right, it sounds fake. Duncan McDuffie. Okay, so he's this really successful real estate developer in the early 1900s, and he made these developments in Berkeley called Claremont Court and Uplands, which eventually just became like their own neighborhoods. And all of these developments he made came with racial covenants attached to the deeds, which made it illegal for anyone who bought his houses to sell or rent them to people of color.
Ugh, like redlining, isn't that what that is?
Yeah, this was before redlining a little bit, but it was pretty common, these deed covenants, to make it so the neighborhood stayed super white. So next door to the Claremont Court development, right, there was this neighborhood called Elmwood. Now there in Elmwood, a black-owned dance hall was trying to open up. And Duncan McDuffie, a.k.a. McDuschenstein, he didn't like that too much because he thought having black people in the neighborhood won over would lower property values in Claremont Court. So he came up with this new zoning rule saying that only single family houses could go into the neighborhood as a thinly veiled way to prevent the dance hall from opening. And the city expedited the zoning ordinance to his liking to prevent this dance hall from going in. Ugh. So the new zoning rule made Elmwood instantly seem more exclusive. Now developers could charge more for single family homes than they could for like the duplexes or cottage apartments that other people were putting down. Basically, you'd make more money off one plot of land. And this zoning, of course, took off in popularity because everyone is racist and hates poor people. And now single family homes are the main form of home building that happens in the Bay Area today. 83% of land in the Bay Area of California is devoted to single family zoning. And to really wrap your head around this, that means that of all of the land that people can live on in the Bay Area, which is huge and makes up multiple major metropolitan cities, only 17% of that land can be used to build like apartment buildings or even duplexes.
Oof.
Yeah, and this trend, while more prominent in the Bay Area, actually continues across the US, where in total, 75% of residential land is slotted single-family only zoning, meaning it is illegal to build apartment buildings or multiple units on that land. So what this kind of did when it started off in the early 1900s is it just created a lot of segregation. Obviously, like given the history, it's not surprising that single family zoning in a city also increased the percent of white residents that the city has, but there's a couple reasons like why it happened this way. So the first one is that obviously the history of racism in the US has made it so that people of color are more likely to be poor than their white counterparts, right? So in 2020, the overall total poverty rate in the US was around 10%. However, for Hispanic citizens, this figure was more like 16%. And for Black citizens, this rate was almost double their white peers, coming in at 19%. And it makes sense. Companies are less likely to hire Black workers due to racism. And when they do, they're more likely to underpay them. Black workers earn just 60% of what white workers do. And to fire them in times of layoff, even with the same qualifications and experience as their white peers. Additionally, generational experiences with racism have made generational wealth building just harder for Black families than it is for white ones. Black households on median have just 12.7% the amount of wealth that white households do. Additionally, Black applicants are more likely to be denied credit, and when approved, they're more likely to encounter significantly higher interest rates than their white peers, meaning their monthly payments are just higher for things we all use every day, like cars and credit cards. It's basically like a Black tax. And these financial challenges due to systemic racism mean that many Black families cannot afford to purchase single-family homes at the same rate as white families, and they're more likely to live in apartments, which are less competitive and more fairly priced. But the second thing about like how this all contributes to segregation is that when Black families do want to buy a home, they have to contend with the whole racist history of redlining, which you mentioned earlier. Do you know like what redlining was, how it worked exactly?
I kind of do, but I feel like you would probably explain it better because I might be a little wrong.
Okay, so basically in 1933, the U.S. government created all of these new programs designed to make like housing affordable to the middle class and especially to the lower middle class. But really, it was just designed for the white lower middle class. So in doing this, the Federal Housing Administration drew lines around neighborhoods on maps and assigned them value. Low-value areas were outlined in red, hence redlining. But these low-value neighborhoods were extremely difficult to get loans on because they were like, these are like bad bets, banks. And you, as you can imagine, they also happened to be the neighborhoods that were predominantly Black. So meanwhile, the FHA was building new neighborhoods with covenants attached, still making it illegal for those homes to be sold to Black Americans. In cities across the U.S., sheriffs and courts were evicting Black families from their homes that they had already purchased outright because of all these retroactive covenants. So we had white neighborhoods where Black families could not legally purchase, and we had Black neighborhoods where banks had decided homes were too low value to be worth the investment risk of a mortgage, leaving Black families in the dust and contributing to increased segregation. So the FHA made it illegal for Black families to buy in white neighborhoods. And they did this because they argued that it would make property values go down, which would be bad for banks. However, in truth, we saw that when Black families bought homes in all-white neighborhoods, it had the opposite effect. property values rose because these families had such few options that they were willing to pay higher prices for housing, driving up the overall value of every house in the neighborhood. This didn't change policy, though, and Black families were still barred from buying homes in the suburbs into the 50s and 60s, leading them to have no generational equity acquired from having family homes that were increasing in value, like, over all these years. So as white families used the equity from their homes to send their children to college and jumpstart their lives, Black families didn't have the asset available to do the same with. And by 1968, the Fair Housing Act was passed, but homes had appreciated in value so much that Black families were priced out of these neighborhoods. And the legacy of redlining still persists today, with certain neighborhoods still deemed low in value as a result of these practices, making it harder to get a mortgage in Black neighborhoods. When you add in, like, the racism and lending practices, we see Black applicants are denied mortgages at higher rates. 27% of Black applicants were denied in 2015 compared to just 11% of white applicants, or being approved at just, like, way higher interest rates. So single-family zoning was created basically to bar Black people from certain neighborhoods, and in doing so, it created, yeah, the widespread segregation in the United States that persists today. And even now, when places do try to build, like, multi-unit properties, homeowners protest, especially in white neighborhoods. According to one article on Vox, a recent lawsuit against the town of Coxsackie, New York, which is also an unfortunate name, showed that when a developer wanted to build 300 units of moderately priced housing, the town residents all fought back. And one of them in a public meeting said that the residents of these, like, intended future apartments would be like the people you saw on Cops.
Oh.
Like the TV show.
Ooh.
Yeah. So,
we know what that is code for.
Right, yeah, it's code for not white people, right? Even though Cops filmed in my town when I grew up, and there were a lot of white people doing crimes on that episode. It was mostly just, like, white people with guns running from the cops, yelling shit. We had a very Cops-friendly town, I guess.
Oh my gosh, Cops are ready of that. Do you remember that movie Run, Ronnie, Run?
No.
It's by the guys who did Mr. Show.
No.
It's basically like this guy who becomes famous because he goes viral being on a Cops-style show.
Oh, okay.
And he has a mullet.
Wow, that sounds like something that could potentially happen in Fresno.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that. Okay, so, like, one of the other byproducts of, like, single-family homes, like this kind of zoning. In L.A., also, we call it R1 zoning. It's residential one, like, one residential unit. But I think they call it something different everywhere. But one of the byproducts is that it also contributes to homelessness. So now we find ourselves in this position where housing is increasingly unaffordable in the U.S., right? And the lack of multi-unit buildings is a component of that issue. Well, there are more than enough homes for families in the United States, 139 million homes for 123 million families. Many of these homes are being used as second homes or investment properties, which people are content to have sit vacant and unused for tax purposes, or, like we see here in LA, where we have good rent control, people will literally just leave units vacant with really, really high rents on them, waiting for the right renter to come along, because there's a chance you're going to be stuck with that renter for 10 plus years, because rent control is so good, so you want to get the highest price you can. Well, that just means that people are willing to take the hit to wait for, like, months and months and months until someone comes along who will pay top dollar for it.
Yeah, that's the, like, tricky thing about rent control. Like, I don't think I would have been able to stay in my apartment, you know,
right,
an affordable apartment without rent control. But what rent control can do is drive up rental prices for vacant units.
Yeah, it's a very interesting issue. It's like there needs to be, instead of, like, rent control, we need, like, maximum rents. One of the ideas I always had that I thought would be good is that you take the, like, average income of a neighborhood and you divide that by 12 months in the year, and then you divide that by 4, and that's the maximum per bedroom you're allowed to charge for, like, a rental unit in that neighborhood. I thought that would be cool.
Yeah, I do think that if we're gonna have the system that we have now, like, capping rent, like, having, like, a maximum rent would be probably more beneficial than rent control.
Yeah, exactly. I think something like that would be good too. So yeah, we do have over 7 million houses alone in the U.S. that are second homes or vacation homes, and 17 million homes sit vacant. And lots of people I've seen on the internet are like, well, those homes don't exist where people are. And that's actually not true. So where we live in Los Angeles, there are 1.4 million households, that's like families who live together, and 1.5 million homes. So it's almost a perfect match. We have more homes than families. However, we also have 64,000 unhoused people within the city limits, and currently 93,000 units are vacant within the city limits, and those are all used as second homes. So, like the U.S. on the whole, we actually have enough houses for every household, but until we're content passing, like, big laws, like regulating the permissible rents of these homes at an affordable rate, or making real estate investors insure a certain percent of everything they own becomes just public housing, or simply stipulating that nobody gets a second home until everyone has a first one, this leaves us with what I consider to be an artificial housing shortage. The houses are there, but the policies we have in place mean they may as well not be. So while YIMBY advocates, which is Yes in My Backyard, right, who are advocates of building like more housing, advocates like Laura Foote say, we are never going to achieve generalized levels of affordable housing unless we take on single-family home-only zoning. The reality is actually that there are plenty of other options available, like limiting the number of residential properties any one person can own, making it illegal for companies to own homes altogether, like hello, private property abolition, like what if we literally just said that you can only own a home if you live in it. You know, upzoning actually is the most moderate option on the table to solve the problem. This isn't a super progressive solution. This is almost kind of like a liberal Democrat position, you know, like instead of addressing the issues of like house hoarding, people are like, well, we could build more units so that everybody can have multiple houses is kind of the idea.
Mm-hmm.
But as it stands, you know, in LA where we live, 67% of all residential units are owned by private investment companies.
Yeah, I lived in a place that where it was like, I believe this company just bought up a bunch of like houses and rental units during the recession and then just rented them out at like making a killing.
Yeah, that's something major that happened. Yeah, when the housing market crashed, people just came in, people with deep pockets came in and bought up a bunch of units. And these investment companies do this with real estate because the relative scarcity of housing and relatively high demand for housing form like this investment gold mine, right? From an investment perspective, it's a good way to get richer. Like if the stock market S&P goes up 10% every year on average, like housing prices in Los Angeles go up more than that.
Yeah. And it's like, okay, people, like I've always paid my rent first, like even before food, before anything. Like,
right.
I pay my rent first, and I feel like most people I know are like that. So it's like, people will pay their rent, people will pay their mortgage before everything else, you know what I mean? So it's like, it's kind of fucked up, but it is a good investment because people don't want to be evicted.
Right, you have like a lock on something people need.
Because you need that.
Like, yeah, you need housing. So these real estate investors, basically, they short the market, they drive up the demand, then they rent for extremely high prices because the supply has been shorted, but they're the ones who shorted the supply. And those who can't afford the high rents, they end up on the streets. So we talked about this in our episode about homelessness, but communities where people spend over 32% of their monthly income on rent experience greater rates of homelessness. There's a direct correlation between high rents and being unhoused. And single-family houses cost more. They cost more to build, they cost more to buy, and they cost more to live in, even as a renter. Freestanding homes fetch higher rents, and when your city is 75% freestanding homes, that means your odds of paying more for rent are high, too. So there was this article on Brookings.edu that explained this. This is kind of a quote. They said that the U.S. needs to build more housing and less expensive housing, especially in high-opportunity communities. To accomplish that, local governments must reduce regulatory barriers that limit the market's ability to build small, lower-cost homes on expensive land. For example, local zoning regulations prohibit building anything other than single-family detached houses on three-quarters of the land in United States cities. Townhouses, duplexes, and apartment buildings are simply illegal. Even where multifamily buildings are allowed, zoning rules like building height caps and minimum lot sizes often limit the financial feasibility of developing new housing. Single-family houses use more land per home than any other housing type. Therefore, in places where land is expensive, building multiple homes on a given lot is the most direct way to reduce housing costs because it spreads the cost of land across multiple homes. So that was the quote. It's pretty common sense, right? However, this also obviously, yeah, drives down the investment value of those 67% of homes owned by companies here in LA, for example, which is why these companies tend to fight against what they call upzoning, changing the housing zoning to build more units on each plot of land. The exclusionary zoning laws work to their advantage to keep rents and property values as high as possible, and the poorer are viewed as expendable resources. So obviously, what we really need is just free public housing,
mm-hmm.
right? Or making private property, which is things like owning homes for profit, illegal. Which, you know, again, not to be confused with personal property. If you live in your house, you can own it. That's yours. Private property is just something you own with the intent of making money off of it and not actually using. Like, we should just make that shit illegal. That's not helping anybody except for rich people get richer. But in lieu of that, changing single-family zoning to multi-unit housing does at least increase supply. And theoretically, that should lower costs and make houses more affordable for everyone. However, experts do explain that just adding in more housing on its own isn't enough. We also need to make sure that housing prices are regulated with government intervention to suit a range of incomes. There's also these people who, like, are supply skeptics with housing, who are like, yeah, just building more houses won't actually necessarily make them more affordable, though. And some experts have kind of looked into that, and they're like, well, data does show that when you build more housing, it does, like, the supply and demand thing gets thrown off, right? You have more supply to meet the demand, so the price goes down a little bit. But when they look into it in detail, that only really benefits, like, lower middle class people. When you have people who are, like, poor and can barely pay their rent, that actually doesn't help them. And they are the ones who are most at risk of losing shelter, right?
Yeah, because I feel like everything that I see that is new being built in LA is not, like, affordable housing. It's, like, it's either luxury apartments or, like, it's usually luxury apartments or condos, you know,
right.
Luxury, like, stuff that's, like, more, like,
frou-frou, fancy.
Not, and I mean, not, like, super, super fancy, not, like, Beverly Hills mansion
right.
fancy, but it's, like, more than the average person working a normal job could afford. Like, someone who was working retail couldn't afford one of these.
Yeah, a thing I think is interesting about those, though, is they contribute to this thing called the fishbowl effect, which actually stops gentrification in a really interesting way. Yeah, so they build these places, and they target, like, upwardly mobile young professionals, like yuppies, basically. You know, you're, like, middle class, but, like, you're young. And what they found is that people like this like to be around other people like this. They don't want to be around the poor, basically. So if you build a place for them to go, they'll all kind of stay in their own fishbowl, just around each other. But if you don't build places for them to go, that's when they start gentrifying neighborhoods. And because they like to stay together, when a few people move into a neighborhood, everyone else follows suit.
Interesting.
Yeah, and that's kind of what we saw happen with, like, Highland Park, right? So people got priced out of some neighborhoods, and then, like, white yuppies started to kind of move, like, young white yuppies started to move into Highland Park, for example, here in Los Angeles, which is a neighborhood that gentrified pretty rapidly. And then even their friends with a little more money wanted to be there because they wanted to be around people like them. And then you see all these people who'd been in these communities for a long time getting displaced. So it's kind of like this chain reaction that happens with those. So obviously we do need more affordable housing to be built, and I think, like, what we were talking about, like, the cap on rents in general for already existing properties would do that. That would
mm-hmm.
be significant. But if we are going to build new housing, it's not necessarily bad, apparently, that a lot of it serves the middle class, because that means they have somewhere to go where they're not gentrifying lower income communities of color around them. I know, I thought that was super interesting. There was this, like, study done about it happening in downtown LA and how people, they started building these units because they thought it would slow the gentrification of, like, the Byzantine quarter down on, like, Pico Union area. Yeah, super interesting. But, you know, whatever. I feel like all of these things, it's interesting reading about them because I'm like, oh, I know the answer. Just give people free houses.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, just give people free housing, but and not make it like, oh, well, all the poors need to have this one bedroom shack with, like, no toilet.
Right, exactly. We already have existing
it's
housing.
It's like, you need to just, like, I think that, like, also, like, an important thing is, like, make it so you just don't put all the, like, people you want, like, or, you know, people that society deems, like, you know, poor or, like, you know, not middle class, like, all in one area to be like, well, we can look away now and they can keep, like, the shitty part. It's like, you have to, like, have stuff that's nice and, like is interwoven in, like, the larger community and, like,
oh yeah, desegregate. Yeah, you definitely have to do that. That's also an interesting thing with, like, advocacy work for the unhoused. Like, lots of people want to put unhoused people all together just in one big apartment building and be like, have fun. But, like, actually what's more successful is giving unhoused people homes in communities where the majority of people are not unhoused. you know?
Yeah, I think that's what I was, like,
yeah, exactly. thinking about. Yeah, you need to, like, acclimate people to, like, the community and have a community that's there to serve them. Like, yeah, it is. You need to desegregate communities, basically. And that also ensures, like, resources are adequately distributed to everybody yeah. without bias.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so, you know, we've got all this thing, but the single-family zoning also contributes to declines in home ownership for just, like, individuals, which is interesting. So even for people who are able to rent homes, the limited supply of housing drives up the price of housing on the whole, which creates a significant issue barring them potentially from a future of home ownership and economic stability on the whole. Not to mention, many people who want to purchase homes would much prefer, like, apartments or condos, like me, but due to issues like FHA loans failing to cover many of those options and the lower supply of these homes to begin with, potential buyers are driven towards these higher-priced single-family homes, which are often too large for their needs and often a little on the pricier side. So there was this one article where they interviewed a Sacramento, I think, renter. Her name was Bridget Driller. And she said that home ownership feels completely impossible, mostly because there's not a lot of options for her. So she has this quote where she said, you know, there are a lot of single family homes, which I don't really want. What I would love to see is more of that middle category of apartment complexes.
Yeah, or like a little condo.
Right, exactly. Something that's more like that's yours, so you can still like own it and have stability and build some sort of equity, although not the wild, widespread equity that happens when people are artificially jacking up the prices of everything. Just like stability and something for your future, but you don't necessarily need a full-size single-family house with a yard.
Yeah, like if you're one person with like maybe one pet or maybe no pets.
Right.
You really only need like, you know, you don't need a ton of space.
Right. So, you know, when people aren't able to own their own homes, it also does this really interesting thing that I think about a lot because I'm in the process of trying to save for my retirement, which is that it leads to diminished retirement savings for Americans.
Yeah.
So for many Americans, retirement is like this ever-looming issue in front of them. And economists recommend that you have $2 million saved for retirement here in the U.S.
Oh, God.
It's actually like $1.9 million. I rounded up a little. But still, it's a lot of money. I'm not even shooting for that. I'm shooting for $1 million for retirement. And even then, I'm like, can I do it by the age of 65? And for most Americans approaching retirement, which is age 65 to 74 now, most Americans have, on average, $426,000 saved. So, like, a quarter of what economists say they need. And it's easy to see why, even for, like, middle-class people, retirement savings is the number one financial stress that they face. Americans who own their own home have a net worth that is 80 times larger than their peers who rent.
Wow.
But only about 50% of Americans own their own homes. And many retirees rely on their home being worth more than they owe on the mortgage payment, meaning they have equity, that's what that is, which they can use to fund their survival in their elderly years when they're unable to work. So home ownership is an important part of many people's retirement plans. Additionally, home ownership means that you'll be paying less in monthly housing costs if you stay put a while in a place you own, rather than if you were a lifetime renter without rent control or a lifetime renter who moved around a lot. And the reason why is that if you have a fixed rate mortgage, your mortgage payments don't go up, even as housing costs around you continue to rise. Because of rising costs of rent but stagnating costs of mortgage payments, renters are 89.9% more likely than homeowners to be behind on their housing payments.
Wow.
Yeah. So when I bought my house in November 2018, or my half of my detached duplex or whatever, my monthly mortgage payment for a 3-bedroom, 2-bathroom house was $2,371.14, which I split with my boyfriend. And the average rent for a place that size at that time where I live was a little bit less. It was $2,231 per month, so around $140 cheaper than my place when I bought it. Now, though, it's only been 3 years, right? The average rent for my same size house is $2,735.
Wow.
Yes, so it is now $363.86 more per month than our mortgages for the same size house.
Wow.
And that happened in just 3 years.
Wow.
Rents go up, but my mortgage stays the same. So my mortgage is actually slated to be paid off in full when I reach the age of 65, which is convenient because that is retirement age for many people in the U.S. And this means that when that happens, all I will have to pay going forward for my house is insurance and property taxes. And since I live in a place where property taxes don't increase as long as you live in your home, those taxes will stay the same as they were the day I bought the house. And this means that my monthly living expenses for housing in Los Angeles could be as low as $789.17 per month for a 3-bedroom, 2-bathroom house when I retire.
Wow.
And in 30 years' time, that will feel like just $376 a month due to inflation.
Wow.
Which I will split with my boyfriend, so it will feel like we are paying. I mean, if he's still alive by then, which statistically, I think we both will be alive.
Yeah, isn't the average age like 80-something?
No, we never have hit 80 in the United States.
Oh, I forgot we talked about this on the episode.
Other countries hit 80. We hover below. I think we're 77. But yeah, if it's both of us, like, what is that? It's $190 a month each, it'll feel like we're paying for our 3-bathroom house.
And then if you have your retirement and Social Security, you're all set.
We'll be
You don't got to work anymore.
We'll be doing all right. As long as I can keep making my payments on this house for the next 30 years, I feel like I can survive as an elderly person potentially not working. And this could be why longtime homeowners have larger savings accounts on average outside of their home equity than renters do too. Because as time goes on, when you live in the same house for a while, your wages sometimes increase along with inflation, probably not up to speed with inflation because capitalism is evil, but you know, your wages tend to increase a little over time, but your monthly housing prices stay the same. So you're able to save more and more money. But if you're a renter and you don't have the benefit of rent control, or you move around a lot, your housing costs get more expensive as your wages get up, and your housing costs get more expensive than your wages. It's a disproportionate increase because wages and pay in the United States are stagnating. So home ownership, in short, it's a helpful like tool for financial stability long term and for retirement planning for many people who don't make enough money to comfortably do both. However, the high rates of competition over housing in general mean declining rates of home ownership faced with higher rates of landlordship and renting. The low supply makes purchasing real estate a great financial investment. So capitalists are all too eager to buy up the stock, leaving many Americans unhoused completely or housing insecure or even at risk just for their own retirement as a result. So, okay, perhaps the most appealing thing to me about ending single family zoning, even though it's not like as radical as I think it should be, right? I think the most appealing thing, though, is that it would increase urban density, right? So that would have like a huge impact on how our cities work, our city planning. So having multiple units on each property increases urban density and ultimately makes neighborhoods more walkable on the whole, which is additionally more environmentally friendly since it diminishes our reliance on cars. And tying in with our episodes about like public transportation and the dangers of driving, having walkable cities or areas easily serviced by buses and trains is good for the people, good for the planet, and even the economy, driving more businesses to shops and storefronts off of rail lines and on the streets where people pass by. They walk by these stores and they're more likely to just stop in.
Yeah, and it's cuter.
Yeah, so basically, at the end of the day, the fight to end single-use zoning, it's like a liberal fight rather than a progressive one, I think. It's a band-aid on the greater issue at hand, which is that housing should be a human right and free to everyone. However, as far as band-aids go, there's some good that can be seen in this push to end single-family zoning. Cheaper rents mean fewer people in the streets, we know that. Increased urban density means fewer commuting deaths and less car pollution, we know that. Increased home ownership means more financial stability, we know that. And these things, fewer people living on the streets, fewer commuting deaths, less pollution, more financial stability, these are all positive changes from where we are today.
Yeah.
So is it the massive overhaul housing needs? No, I don't think so. But it's something, and something is better than nothing.
I agree.
So, Kenna, what do you think? What are our thoughts about this?
Yeah, I agree that it is definitely the end goal is like housing for everybody. I have a hot take, mansions for everybody.
Yeah, I love your mansions for everybody platform.
But I mean like mansions in the sense of like your own personal mansion. Your personal mansion could be the size of an apartment.
Yeah, whatever you want.
But and like also no money, free housing, free everything.
Yeah.
But until then, yeah, it's like one thing you could do right now is definitely increase the density, which would probably also increase public transportation, like have the cities like planned better for like life with like many people in one area. Like, yeah, it seems like, yeah, it's like also like it definitely like when people are like, we don't want apartments by where we are, they're like, well, we don't want the poors, or like we don't want like, you know, people are like, you know, like wink wink, and you're like, what do you mean? And you're like, oh, dog whistle.
Yeah,
like,
it's racist.
Yeah. Where yeah. it's just like, people have such a weird thing in this country against, like, dense housing and apartment buildings. And I remember you showing me, like, this apartment building, I think in the Netherlands, where, like, yeah. everybody had, like, their own, like, backyard patio garden, and it was all pretty, and, like, the, like, people lived next to each other for, like, years and years, and it was, like, a little community, but it was, like, a huge, sprawling, like, apartment building.
Yeah, it was, like, this massive apartment building in a Nordic country, and it was public housing, so it wasn't free, but it was, like, heavily subsidized, and yeah, everybody had their little patios with planters built in where they grew food. They grew their own food, and they had, like, nets over them so, like, birds couldn't come eat the food. Like, it was safe. And then they also, within these units, had, like, all these community workshops. They had, like, a woodwork, like, workshop in there that people could go to. They had, like, 3 public indoor pools and, like, 2 outdoor pools. And, yeah, there was, like, this couple that had lived there for, like, 30 years, and then when their child became an adult, their child applied to get an apartment in the unit, too, and they got to stay there with their partner, and then they had a new baby, and they were like, yeah, I grew up in this place. I'd never want to leave this place. Like, why would I want to leave? It's, like, this total bustling apartment community.
Yeah, and I think just, like, this, like, it definitely is, like, a cultural American thing to be like, well, I want my own house with my own, like, it's basically like you have everybody has their own little islands, which I don't know if, I think people are like, yeah, I want my, privacy, like, for sure, we all want our privacy, but it's like, I think that people are just, don't realize that they might like something different, because it's just been so culturally ingrained, like, especially in the media, you know, yeah. Or like, it's this way, like, if you have, like, you know, I think for, like, millennials, too, like, owning, like, a single home is, like, very much, like, a status symbol, because now it feels like you're rich.
Yeah, that's true, which is pretty wild.
Yeah, like, also, like, I feel like stuff that, like, used to seem normal, like, for, like, boomers and before, where it's, like, house, kids, car, like, all of those seem, like, rich things to me now, like, rich status symbols, even though, like, I have a car now. I'm like, woo.
Yeah, no, it's totally true. I mean, even like Camilla, who we were talking about earlier, she just bought her house, and it's not like a fancy house, but she bought it. And she said that people she was telling, they were all like, did your mom help you? Did, you know, they couldn't figure out that like she had just done it. And, you know, the reason why Camilla was able to do it is because our job pays us well, but it doesn't pay us like exorbitantly well.
Yeah, and like,
and even that's unachievable for people.
And like, you know, Camilla's on a budget.
Yeah, Camilla's on a tight budget.
She's on a very tight budget. And yes. Like, for me, when I think about purchasing a house, where I'm like, well, my budget needs to get even tighter. It's not like,
right.
It's not like I'm like, woo, I have all this money and I can buy a house. It's like, you know, ooh, tightening the belt a little bit. Like, got to be strategic. Like, it's not
strategic.
They don't, like, it's not easy. It's not easy. Where to me, it's like, you know, I was listening to this book called, I believe it's The Utopia of Bureaucracy.
Oh.
It's by the guy who did the 5,000 Years of Debt book.
Oh, David Graeber.
Yes, David Graeber. And he talks about, like, basically the violence of bureaucracy.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, it's so fascinating where I think, like, all this stuff, all these hoops that you have to go through to get, like, especially, like, housing that you own, which can do so much for your future in this mm-hmm. society that we live in. Like, I'm like, wow, it's not like, to me, it's like, it should just be like, you get a house. Like, it's easy. Like, people are just like, oh, yeah, I just got one. Or like, oh, I got a place to live. Oh, it was so easy. But like, now it's like, you have all these forms to fill out. You got to verify your income. You got to verify your employment. You have to fill out all these forms. And if you fill out the paperwork wrong, you're fucked. You got to start over again. And then you might miss the opportunity for the housing. Like, I just think about, like, I mean, that's tied up in so many things, but it's like, the way that you have to strategize things that should be like a human right. Like, you have to strategize to save for a house. You have to strategize to know how to pay for health insurance or get, like, you know, it's never just like easy, and it's not easy on purpose.
Yeah, that's true. I think about that. Okay. So like, when I was like, I want to buy a house, I'm going to figure it out. My best friend and I had to strategize to buy a duplex together because we couldn't afford to each buy our own house. So that was like strategy number one. Like, strategy number two, I did this years ago, so it's before our incomes got, you know, middle class income, which we are. So I was like, in the HUD designation for I think it was very low income. It's like, some really simple way they word it or whatever. I was making like $40,000 a year at the most or something in LA, which I know in other places that sounds like a lot of money, but here it's pretty rough. So, and most people don't even make that. Our minimum wage here is $32,000 a year. So people are surviving on minimum wage here, which is wild. But yeah, so I did that and I was like, I can only eat lentils and rice. So for like 2 years, literally every single meal I ate was lentils and rice. And that was just normal to me because I'm like, well, I got to buy a house and this is the way I'm going to do it. You know, I just eat lentils and rice every day. And, you know, like compromising and sacrificing my health just to have stable housing. And it's fucked up because, yeah, when we did it, it felt like such a triumph. Right. I'm like, oh, my God, like I have a house now.
Yeah. And it seems it's almost like a weird, like, I don't know if libertarian is the right word where it's like, I did it. I scrimped and saved and I, like, it's like, you know, I did the marathon, like.
Yeah, it's like a pride thing, but also then, I don't understand, some people do it and they're like, so everybody can, and I did it and I was like, that was fucked up.
Yeah, like.
Nobody should have to do that.
I eat lentils and my stomach hurts very bad.
I think you have a legume allergy.
I think I have a legume sensitivity that would prevent me from doing that, but it's like, yeah, and some people can't, like.
No, it's yeah, it's pretty wild, but no, you're right, you do, you have to strategize all these things that should just be, like, basic human rights, right, like, anybody should be able to do it, and it is by design that it's harder. I think something that's really interesting is, prior to the Great Recession of 2008, it was easier to get a mortgage on a house. So basically, you know, these banks were lending to people, like, and it didn't matter if they could pay the mortgage or not. They would, like, foreclose on the house and then they would sell it at auction and it didn't really matter. And they would set them up with these, the variable interest loans which is like, okay, now you can afford it. But if your interest rate on your loan is variable, that means that next year it could go up. And then all of a sudden, if the interest rates go up a lot because they're set by the federal government, like, your mortgage payment every month could end up being double what it was the previous year. And then suddenly you can't pay. And rather than cracking down on banks for giving these, like, fucked up loans, instead it's like they punished people. The way they cracked down on banks, air quotes, is by being like, well, you got to make them jump through hoops now to get these loans.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how you have all these people who could comfortably afford to pay a mortgage. They're paying more for rent most of the time, especially in major cities, than a mortgage would be, but they can't get approved on a mortgage.
Yeah, and it's like, it's one of those things where they blame it on the individual person rather than blaming it on the structure that has been set up. Like, the structure for the banks, it was, I mean, if you read that book, like, oh gosh, what is it? It was a movie with Brad Pitt in it.
The Wolf of Wall Street?
No, about, what? Like, the guys who made a bunch of money.
The Big Short?
The Big Short.
I watched it.
Yes, I read the book.
Yes, okay.
So it's like basically the system is set up for basically the banks to gamble with your money. Like, it is just the way that it's set up, it is set up for the banks to screw you, basically. And so it's like there are all these like weird rules that they just make up out of nowhere. Like, it's like Monopoly money or something. I don't know. They blame it on, like, oh, these like people who borrowed the money should have known better. And I'm like, without this book, I wouldn't have understood the process. You think just a normal person is going to understand all the, like, rules? Like, weird rules that the banks have set up, but you're like, oh, it's the individuals, it's not the structures that the banks have set up because through, like, you know, lobbyists and stuff.
Right. And of course, like, I remember this. I'm sure you remember this when this was all happening. So when we were, like, experiencing the Great Recession, basically, remember, they were, like, bailing out the banks, but not the people who got the bad loans. Do you remember that?
Yes. And, they just made all the people be like, well, these people were grifting the banks.
And it's right.
Like, no, the banks were grifting the people.
Yeah, exactly. They were like using their money. Like you said, it's like Monopoly gambling money. But yeah, I just, I think it's really interesting. I think the way we approach housing as a commodity obviously is flawed from conception. Like, how can you take something that's so fundamental as like a human right, like we need housing to survive, and then commodify it? And we do the same thing with food, obviously. We're probably going to do the same thing with water, very tank girl of us, right? Oof. To commodify water. But, you know, we have all these things that people need to live, and then we gamble with them, we treat them like assets that can be traded rather than like essential things people need.
Yeah, I think just the whole way that we treat life right now, I mean, it's so intertwined in capitalism. It's like, you know, like when you're a fish, you don't realize that you're in water. You don't realize that you're swimming around in it. I think there's like an Ursula K. Le Guin where you're like, you don't realize that you're basically like swimming around in capitalism. And where it's like, you know, going off what she said, like, you know, 500 years ago, Middle Ages, people, what they thought of was like the rule of kings. Like, of course, like there's always going to be a monarch who was chosen by God or something. Like, that's just, there's kings, there's lords and ladies, and there's serfs. Like, that's just the world. Like, you couldn't think of a world outside of that and the church. Like, you wouldn't even see it.
Right.
Where it's like, right now, we're so intertwined in capitalism, everything that we do, that it's hard to imagine a different world.
Yeah.
But it is there. It's just, it's hard for us to see because we are swimming in it.
It is. It really is. I also, you know, I think it's cool that the idea of building more, this is like my last thought on this, I swear. But I just worry that like in LA, we passed this law now where it's like, okay, fine. You can build what's called an ADU, an accessory dwelling unit. You can build a second unit in your backyard. But the people who are doing this are middle-class people who own the front house, and they're putting these units in their backyard to rent out, to create more income for themselves, to rent at high market rates. So this whole thing, I'm like, yeah, we're not getting to the root of the problem. Like, it's still capitalism.
Yes.
You're just creating more private property for people who had previously just been living in the personal property of their home. Now they get to be petite capitalists in their own backyard, too. And you're like, I don't think that's the right solution.
Yeah. I think that there is a way forward. It's just going to be maybe slogging through for a little bit.
Yeah. We'll get there. But in the meantime, free houses for everyone.
Yes. Free mansions.
Thanks so much for listening to another episode of Pick Me Up, I'm Scared. If you would like to follow us on Patreon, we are patreon.com/pickmeupimscared. For $2 a month, you can sign up to receive bonus episodes, a link where you can leave us voicemails, and some other weird content we post on there sometimes. I think I posted a 90s music video a couple of weeks ago for a song called Heaven is a Halfpipe. So yeah, $2 a month. You can check that out. And if you don't want to give us your $2, that is totally fine. We're still happy you're here.